Hi, I'm Daniel Centeno. I had the opportunity to interview three directors for this year's Hot Docs Film Festival. The first doc is by Nora Kevorkian, and it is called Batata. This is followed by Sarah Taxler's How Saba Kept Singing, and concluded by Daniel Diaz's On Suspicion. Enjoy. So this film continues your focus on Lebanon, but it expanded greatly here. How did the 10-year documentation idea get developed?
It's a very good question. It takes a long time to explain because so much has happened over a decade. So I should tell you a little bit about myself because it really tells you why I was interested in this film. I was born in Syria. My mom is Syrian and my dad is Lebanese. So I grew up in Lebanon. And all my life, I felt a tension and kind of a love-hate relationship between the Syrian and the Lebanese people, because Lebanon and Syria are both Arab countries that are neighboring. And especially during the Lebanese Civil War, this tension, this cultural dislike between the two people was very pronounced. So I always wanted to make a film about this tension and dive into this topic, but I didn't want to make a political film. So I was always looking for a really interesting subject so I could tell this story. And finally, it happened. In 2008, I was visiting my parents who live in the Bekaa Valley province in Lebanon. And my mom's friend, Musa, a Christian Lebanese landowner, was visiting. And he invited me to go and have a coffee at the Syrian Muslim migrant farm. In the Middle East, everything is religious and social backgrounds. That's why I'm specifying this. And so when I went to have coffee there, from far, I saw this beautiful, charismatic woman walking from far in a red dress. She already caught my eye, and her name is Maria. And so I realized that this is it. I found the subjects for this really exciting documentary that I could tell. We have a Muslim woman who's a farmer and comes from Syria and works for a Christian Lebanese man. So it was the perfect setting. So the following year, I had a newborn baby. She was 8 weeks old, and I had my three-year-old son and a backpack of cameras. I went to Lebanon to start shooting Batata. So that was in 2009, in the fall of 2009. And of course, we were still shooting the following year, year and a half into filming, the Syrian revolution started. And then the Syrian war, then the Syrian refugee crisis. And I had so much had happened that I kept continuing to film and film. And then the story of Batata became much larger. It became a story of all these Syrian refugees who were coming to Lebanon. And it became a bigger story about refugees, their lives in the camps, and it went on for 10 years. And so now the film is finished, and it looks like it's a very, very timely film, considering what's happening right now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I want to know, like, I guess more of the on the ground work for your own experience. How did that go? And how did you get to know, like, a lot more of the individuals there as well, beyond Maria?
Well, because initially the film was supposed to be a 2-year period of following potato farmers. So I had already been there a year and a half when the revolution started. So I had already spent time with Maria and her entire Syrian family, who were the migrant workers, and had established a relationship with them. I cared for them. You know, documentary filmmakers become friends with their subjects in order to get the stories. So that had already happened. So when the revolution started, all of us, Maria and all her huge family, all of us, including me, got propelled and sucked into the revolution. And we thought, and all of us thought that this was going to be 6 months. And then when the war started and all of their Syrian family, cousins, aunts, uncles, they were all escaping Syria and coming to Lebanon, where Maria and all her father, mother, uncles were living. then I realized that, wow, this is becoming completely different. And because I was underground with them, we were welcoming all the new families. I started to get to know them and slowly, slowly started having friendships and relationships with all these people who were coming. So it was a gradual process. And over time, it became a huge community for me. So I think one of the reasons why I was able to make this film as a one-woman show is because it became necessary for me to be one-woman show so that I can have that access. I kind of flipped the thought. But it was just me with the camera being there and welcoming the new people, meeting them, interviewing, getting their stories. It just was a very different experience. I think I was so fallen into the story. I was so attached to the characters and the people, the story, the war, that I wasn't able to stop filming, which meant I had hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage. And when the pandemic happened, I was forced to stop filming because I had an appointment and a schedule to fly to Lebanon in March of 2020 to continue the shoot with Maria, which obviously got canceled because of the pandemic. So that's when it hit me. I realized that, okay, I'm stuck now in a house with kids and there's nothing to do but to edit. So it was a monstrous amount of footage. And I spent the last 2 years editing. And even though it was challenging physically, I think I was the only one who could edit this film, mostly because it is like beyond anyone's budget to be able to pay someone for 2 years of constant editing. That thing aside, being able to remember, because we don't have logs. This is not a movie shoot where you have everyday shooting logs of you know, what you've shot, which character. Nothing like that exists, obviously, over the years. We have a little bit of organization. So part of what I found is that the editing was re-traumatizing, because then I was here in Canada editing, but I was remembering everything that happened, all the people who had, you know, things happened. I don't want to give away what's happening in the film for people who want to see, but there's lots of exciting things. You think you're watching something else happens. So a lot of things happened, and I had to relive a lot of that during the editing. And then it became to a point towards the end where hundreds of hours of footage, 400 plus hours of footage, I was able to edit it down to 3 hours and some, close to 4 hours. And that's when I got stuck, because I did not want to cut away one frame. These were people whose lives I had captured. They mattered. Some of them were dead. I just couldn't cut it anymore. I cared for them. These were real people. And that's one of the reasons why I was there, capturing their lives. So that's when we brought in another editor, a very experienced editor, Mike Mann, who came in and he cut the film. He was able to cut it because I couldn't. And then we have the format, which is now 2 hours. Early on, I decided that, you know, I didn't want to tell this like a news footage or a current affair documentary with talking heads and telling what's going on. I thought people had already had that chance every day watching the news or, you know, following things. So for me, it was, you know, as I come from a storytelling background, I like to tell stories. And for me, it was so interesting for me to be able in this film take the audience to the refugee camp with me. That was the plan. That's why this is, it's a variety film where you come along and you meet Maria, you see what they're doing, how she cooks, how they sleep, how they work the land. It's really an experience. I think that's the magic of movies, is you get to go somewhere that usually you can't. You get to meet people, how they wash their dishes, how they burn the heat and collect the wood. But throughout all that, you hear what's happening in current affairs. And, you know, everyone knows what's happening with Bashar Assad, what he's doing, the chemical weapons, the war, this or that. That's all happening around them. I try to focus on Maria and the entire camp of, you know, 1,000 people to 2,000 people in the combined in the two camps. And everything else was happening around them. So having lived there with them, being there, that was exactly the experience. You sit in a tent, freezing, the radio's on, the TV's on, you're always on your phone, and you know what's going on. You hear everything going on through the media. And so I try to replicate that experience for the audience.
In a way, your film kind of reminds the world right now that the conflict in Syria is not over. The refugee crisis is still going on. So for the audiences who are preparing to watch your film at Hot Docs, what do you hope they leave with after the screening?
I would like people to, know, I mean, my heart goes out to, all of our hearts go out to the conflict in Ukraine and 3 million people displaced. And I know exactly how that feels, having experienced it with the Syrian refugees. But I'd like people to also remember that the Syrians did this already 10 years ago. This year is the 10th anniversary of the Syrian refugee crisis. The revolution started in 2011. The following year, 2012, the Maria and entire 6 million Syrian are displaced. It's the largest mass migration, forced displacement in current times. And that 10 years later, they are still stuck in the refugee camps. So if people can remember this, it would be a big step forward. It is that, you know, we can't forget being sucked into the current affairs, rightfully so. I totally know how horrible it is for the Ukrainians going through this. We need to also remember the Syrians, that they're still stuck there. And I'd love for people to go and see Batata, just so that they have an experience of what it feels like and see what the refugees go through every day, have a firsthand experience. And I'm hoping that they will be inspired to help, because I think all refugees need our help. So Maria, I could say, this very strong woman, I feel that she's starting to break. When I talk to her, the despair and the hopelessness is actually reaching her now. It is something that I never expected from her. Life continues. I mean, that's the other thing about Batata, is that this film takes place over a period of 10 years. And so much happens. It's not just the stories of refugees. It's not just, you know, it's not heart-wrenching, sad story after sad story. It's not like that, because life is not like that. Even in war and refugee crisis, you have happy things like a wedding, a baby being born, and all these things, right? That's why it's such a balanced film. So you get to experience every part or stages of life.
So I guess right now, because your last film before this was 23 Kilometers. So from that film to Batata right now, how do you think that you changed as a filmmaker, I guess, in terms of your growth, development, or even the outlook towards your work?
That's a good question, because 23 Kilometers was made during the making of this film, because I started in 2009, I started both films at the same time. Batata, because it was the right time for the potato harvest to be filmed in the fall of 2009. And around that time, the end of 2009, I started filming for 23 Kilometers, because the main character of that film has Parkinson's disease and he was getting sicker. So we had to move fast to film him. So between 2009 and 2015, that period, the film finished and it was already in festivals. So I was able to make a film during the Batata making. So they're very different films. 23 Kilometers is more of an experiential film. It's shot like a drama, It has very beautiful lighting. The main character of the film doesn't speak. So it's very artistic film. Everything is set up like a drama, even though it's a documentary, because the main character can only move or speak limited. So I'm not sure we can compare them, but Batata was completely different. It was so free. And because it was just me, I didn't have crew like I did 23 kilometers. I kind of had to think on my feet, you know, because I started making one thing and turn out to something else. I was not emotionally and psychologically prepared to face all that happened to me. So I wasn't prepared to deal with the trauma and the difficulties. I'm not, you know, emotionally I'm speaking. So that had a huge toll on me. It to a point where I started suffering from depression and PTSD and all these. So those are, I think, really important things to talk about as to what filmmakers, these kind of filmmakers who are, you know, doing things on their own and are working on the ground can be affected. And that really has a lot of effect later on. So now I would be very careful in choosing a subject for a film, because I don't think I can do this again. It was just so harrowing and difficult as a woman, as a filmmaker, as a human being, that I don't think I'm healed enough to venture on another film like this. It's just really daunting.
That was Nora Kevorkian, director of Batata. Next up is Sarah Taxler speaking about her film, How Saba Kept Singing. Wait, so how did the name of the film get chosen?
A few things. So one is the main character of the film is a guy named David who goes by Saba. And he believes, he has always believed that he survived the concentration camps because he had has a beautiful voice and would sing for his Nazi captors. And then when his grandson and his family start to ask some questions, it comes to light that David doesn't exactly know his entire story of how he survived. And there's a bit of a mystery. Is there more to it? Was there someone or something that also helped him to survive and to keep singing? So the name's kind of a nod to that. And the question of how exactly did Saba keep singing?
Mm-hmm. And what does the term Saba mean, or the name Saba?
Saba means grandfather in Hebrew. So Saba, David became a grandpa and his kids call him Saba. They also call him Sabinator, Sabala Babala, lots of other nicknames, but Saba is just the word for grandpa in Hebrew.
So for you, how long was the filming process and how did you get to first know David?
The filming process was over a couple of years, filming and editing, but I actually started on this film a few decades ago in nursery school, which is not where most of my film ideas came, but I became friends with Dove, who was one of David's grandsons, and we became friends, and David's son, Eric, was my family's rabbi growing up, kind of all through my life. He retired a couple of years ago, but I knew the family and knew that David was a singer and that he had survived the camps because of his singing voice, but I had never heard him perform really or knew his story. And a couple of years ago, I went to see him in New York City, and he and Avi, his grandson, were doing a concert together, and it was at a synagogue, and the guy who introduced them was the rabbi of the synagogue, and he said they had known each other for a few decades. And David, when they met, didn't tell his story. Like a lot of survivors, it was too hard to talk about. But David would come and help out at their synagogue. And one weekend, the rabbi had to go out of town for a family event. So we asked David to take over the service and for that Friday night. And so David said, okay, but he asked what he should tell a sermon about. And that rabbi told him, I don't know, just tell everybody your story, say why you got into singing. So David was like, all right. So the next Monday, the rabbi came back into work, into his office, and this was in the days of answering machines. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember answering machines, but the light would blink red, and the faster it would blink, the more messages you had. And the light was just blinking like crazy. And the rabbi started to listen to the messages. And the first one said, you should go out of town more often. And then the next one said, I haven't stopped crying since Friday night. So the rabbi went into David and said, what did you tell them? And he was like, oh, you said to say why I started singing. So I told them my story with music and began to tell this incredible story. And then that night in New York City a couple of years ago, David went on to tell all of us his story. And when I heard the details, I just knew it was really unique and special.
Can you comment, please, on how you went with them to Poland and Auschwitz-Birkenau?
Yeah, so we went to Poland. David wanted to go back one final time for the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And we went with him on that journey. And of course, you know, survivors are getting older and many have passed away. And in a way that is super surreal to imagine for us, you know, as people who weren't there at that time, but in a way that maybe might be relatable to your listeners, it almost had a weird school reunion feel. Well, it sounds nuts, but I mean, this is where David spent his teenage years. So he was going back to a place where he knew people and where he had a job in the camp and a place where he had slept. And he had a life during that time, you know, as horrific as so much of it was, there was a bit of, you know, there's nostalgia still. So it was a really strange experience. Avi had a great comment to me that when he first went to Auschwitz, the thing that struck him the most was that it's just another place. And you get there and the sky is blue and there are birds chirping and the wind's blowing. And you realize, like, for every horrible thing that happened there, the people who were inside were human beings who felt the wind blow, you know, who felt the sun on their skin, all of it. And that's not the way we usually see it in movies. You know, we picture this kind of black and white, distant thing that we might purposefully try not to relate to.
One thing I found very central in your film was the part where he says that he wanted to forget everything. Now there's these efforts for him to kind of remember and rediscover and understand, like, that whole story that you mentioned, that there was only parts of it that he was telling his family.
David's story initially was not unlike other survivors in that he didn't want to tell, he didn't want to burden his family with something that was so painful for him. David didn't want to be stuck in the horrors of his own past. So he didn't talk about it for decades. And then once he started, you know, he started to speak to students, and a good friend of his, Doug Servey, who had invited him to talk to students, said it was difficult to talk to kids about it because all the kids he grew up with were murdered, you know? And so he has a really different life experience of what it means to be a teenager, but he did have this love of life. You know, he starts the film by saying, I'm a lover of life. And he's very easy to be around. You know, he likes to joke around and he's a conversationalist and all of these things that you wouldn't know what he had gone through necessarily unless he chose to share it with you. And so in telling his story, we wanted to be respectful of the fact that it was a process for him to even want to get closure, even want to know what happened to him was a really big deal, because in some ways it would have been easier to never revisit any of this at all.
Mm. And in the film, we have another character that you mentioned, it's Zippy. So we first learned about her through the recorded interviews from the Holocaust Museum. For you, what was it like accessing this content and learning about her story as well?
I'm fascinated by Zippy. I think she's was an incredible woman and clever. I mean, she was from, like, small things to huge things. She was, you know, as she said, they had to make it seem like they were following the rules, but their main goal was to help their fellow inmates. And, you know, from things that might seem smaller, like helping people get clean underwear, or things that, you know, we might not even think of as people who've never gone through this, to huge things that get revealed in the movie of ways she tried to make a difference. She just was a clever lady. And there's hours and hours and hours of interviews with her from the Holocaust Museum. So there were lots of stories we couldn't even include, but where she herself came close to death and through a combination of luck and favor she got because of her own skills as an artist, she was able to survive. But she was a real firecracker.
Mm-hmm. And we learn more about her as well through the flashback sequences that you have in there. What was like the decision like for you to have these animated sequences to portray like the stories of their past?
Yeah, so personally, the documentaries I like the most are Verite. And in this story, where a lot of it takes place a long time ago, you know, 3/4 of a century ago, that obviously wasn't going to be an option. So I was trying to think if there was a way to tell the story that feels like it's being told in real time, even for the portions that, of course, are told as memories of the past. And animation seemed to me like a good thing to try out. And it was really important to us to get animation that felt mature and sensitive to the subject matter. But the original idea was to sort of take something dull in the background, dull in terms of color tone, and then have the people pop, with the idea being kind of what I was just mentioning earlier, that this place was a place of darkness, but the people inside were alive and real people and lit up. And that was kind of the starting point. And the animation evolved from there to be these more matted backgrounds. And then the light came in whenever there was an act of defiance or an act of being alive, which in this case might mean singing or forming a connection with another human being or having the life that Nazis were trying to steal from these human beings. So that became kind of the impetus to whenever we would animate something.
People who are seeing this film for the first time, what would you like them to leave with after the screening?
I hope that there's a sense of feeling like you can cope with hard things, that the people in this film, through connection with other people and through music and humor and art, found ways to keep going. And in a very different way, we're all living in a hard time. But my hope is that this movie actually leaves you feeling uplifted at the end of it. As horrific as the setting is, the people are inspiring and I think can lift us up. And so I hope people walk out of this knowing individually that they can get through things, but then also knowing that we're citizens in this world and in many ways, similar and very different. There are things that still go on. And so I hope people are reflective of whether they're looking towards or away from the problems. There's a scene in the movie where David and Avi are in the car going into Auschwitz, and there's houses right outside the gate. And Avi asks if people knew what was going on. And David's like, of course they knew. Everyone knew. I think whenever people know something, you can't unknow it, right? So what I hope is this film isn't just reaching people who are Holocaust film buffs and know a lot about the Holocaust or who've already heard about it and they want to know more. I hope it reaches those people, of course, but the people I really hope watch this film will be the ones who say, oh, I love music, or oh, I love family stories or funny people or that sort of thing, and they're attracted to the story because they hear something good. Those are the people who I really hope see it.
That was Sarah Taxler, director of How Saba Kept Singing. Next up is Daniel Diaz speaking on his film On Suspicion.
My name is Daniel Diaz Oyarzun. I'm from Chile in the Picun Mapu, the Mapuche territory at the north of Hualmapu, which is the ancestral Mapuche territory there in Chile that have place in Argentina also.
So how did the idea of the documentary first come up?
Bajo Sospecha, On Suspicion documentary is narrated in the language of Mapuche people. And I have been learning this language for 6 years ago, but it hasn't been easy because of the racism there in Chile. This is a language that has been prohibited at the first, and then has suffered a lot of discrimination. So I started this narration thinking of my uncle. He's an artist, and he's the first that has strongly, I mean, with a lot of force, has been recovering our ancestral history. So in the family, we are coming back to the roots because of my uncle's artwork that addresses all the stigmas against the indigenous appearance. Indeed, his career started from detention on suspicion. He was arrested on suspicion of robbery, but he was innocent. But all that procedure with the police there was a stigmas working there. So finally, the documentary is a journey throughout the artworks of Bernardo, but also how do I get in touch with the Mapuche identity? He is capable to give us an historical point of view about the past, about the ancient things, but also he combines them with contemporary elements. And yeah, we can watch him making this relationship, I mean, making the relation between Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, but give it a decolonized haze and very critical point of view about the European stereotypes of beauty. And also he managed to bring you an ancient point of view with all those ritual masks, but they are illuminated with LED lights of red colors into a dark room and give you that aesthetic, powerful aesthetic experience to think about what is behind those masks, maybe a community, maybe a country, maybe our ancestors.
For you, when did you decide that Bernardo's story, that was something you wanted to make into a documentary?
I think that we realized that it is an important topic to talk about in 2016, because Bernardo was arrested and just because there was a legal figure, I don't know how to say that, una figura legal. So the cops, the police, has the attribution to detention you, and they were allowed to take you to a commissary, to establishment where the policies, and that figure, legal figure, was eliminated in 1998. But in 2016 was establish it again with another name, because in Chile, the movement, the social movement, were taking a lot of strength, were really powerful in those years. So we realized that the story of abuse from the police were repeating again. And finally, we have been seeing in all these years that the violence of the police and the repression of the state has been repeated again.
I guess right now, for audiences who are going to see your documentary for the first time, what do you hope they learn, they feel, or they take from it after the screening?
The most important to me are the indigenous communities that are claiming to social justice, reparation, and truth. And among them, all those that are fighting for recovering, revitalize, enrich their languages into this situation of colonialism, where they are not allowed to do. And I think that's the most important message to all of them. And on the other hand, to people to give them the opportunity to learn something about another cultures and different words in different ways of thinking, because we need to be heard too, and people want to do that. I mean, there's the opportunity to keep communicating between us, and I think that is something that we have to try. We have to keep listening to each other in different languages. And being here in Hot Dogs, I was talking to a Croatian filmmaker, and how that it happened. From the other side of the world, and we were talking there, and documentaries give us that opportunity to talk to people from all over territories and know each other, because there's people there outside that doesn't want that. They don't want to. They want to we live with fear. And now, and in ignorance about what's happening outside and when what's happening to other people.
That was Daniel Diaz, director of Suspicion. I'm Daniel Centeno. Thanks for listening to my coverage of this year's Hot Docs Film Festival. Until next time, moviegoers.